You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and IBEW Local 124. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEWLocal124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we're celebrating Women's Equality Week with an interview with the National Organization for Women president, Toni Van Pelt. We'll ask her about how the ongoing conspiracy to suppress the right to vote particularly impacts women. Then, we're reading Bernie Sanders' new book called Our Revolution and talking to Jeff Weaver, who is Bernie's campaign manager and closest political advisor, about this historic movement. In the news, 2,000 postal workers rally against privatization, and prison strikes take off across North America. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. Now for the news. The news from our side, August 23, 2018. Tuesday was the 47th anniversary of the death of George Jackson, killed or murdered in San Quentin Prison in either a failed escape attempt or flat-out murder. Jackson was author of an influential book called Soledad Brother, which exposed the inhumanity of that era's prison system, its use of indeterminate sentencing, the drugging of inmates, and the extensive use of solitary confinement and sensory deprivation. A lot has changed since 1971, and it's all worse. Now, the prison industrial complex is worth $2 billion a year as a result of mass incarceration, private prisons, and much more extensive use of prison labor. So, on Tuesday, remembering George Jackson, prisoners across the nation went on strike. They stopped making the food, doing the laundry, cleaning the floors, and doing the outsourced production and service work contracted to private corporations. According to The Guardian, strike leaders say, fundamentally, it's a human rights issue. Prisoners understand they are being treated as animals. Prisons in America are a war zone. Every day, prisoners are harmed due to conditions of confinement. For some of us, it's as if we are already dead. So what do we have to lose? Organizers have put together a list of 10 national demands. They include improved prison conditions, an end to life sentences without parole, increased funding for rehabilitation services and an end to the disenfranchisement of some 6 million Americans with felony convictions who are barred from voting. One of the most passionately held demands is an immediate end to imposed labor in return for paltry wages, a widespread practice in U.S. prisons that the strike organizers call a modern form of slavery. More than 800,000 prisoners are daily put to work. In some states, it's compulsory. In Louisiana, such labor earns you 4 cents an hour. Inmates are not only refusing to work, many are also engaging in hunger strikes, holding sit-in protests and staging a boycott of commissaries, collect phone calls and other payment streams where private and state-owned companies make money out of them. Inmates who join the action know that they face potentially serious consequences like being put in solitary confinement, faced with lockdowns, and even violent retaliation by guards. As prisons lock down and cut off communications, news is trickling in from across North America with reports of sporadic protest actions from California and Washington State to the eastern seaboard as far south as Florida and up to Nova Scotia in Canada. The strike is planned to last until September 9th, another 47th anniversary, this one of the horrific Attica prison rebellion in which New York State troopers opened fire on striking inmates and their hostages, killing dozens and engaging in a rampage of torture and death that lasted for days.
The Kansas City Star reports that 6 fast food workers who work for KBP Foods, which owns KFC restaurants in the area, have sued their employer for wage theft. The workers say they were required to work without pay because of tech problems, management actions, and company policy. They want to be allowed to file a class action lawsuit against the company. KBP Foods operates 581 restaurants in 23 states. Of course, they say they follow the law, and they pay their workers for work done, but the workers claim that they were not paid overtime when they worked over 40 hours a week. They say, quote, management engaged in a scheme to short employees compensable time by routinely deleting time from employees' timesheets. They also claim that KBP rewards managers with bonuses who reduce labor costs, thus creating an incentive to steal employee wages.
At their national convention this week in Pittsburgh, 2,000 members of the American Postal Workers, the APWU, rallied in the streets of Pittsburgh to tell the Trump administration in no uncertain terms that privatization of the post office is off the table. In April, Trump set up a presidential task force to evaluate the U.S. Postal Service. Its report is due this month. Meanwhile, the administration's reorganized government plan made it clear that the task force is likely to recommend privatization of the U.S. Postal Service to sell off the assets of the USPS to private corporations and to end the mandate for universal service that provides for affordable mail and packages to be delivered to 157 million addresses every week. The APWU believes that this would lead to an end to daily delivery for millions of customers, along with higher prices for mail and packages. In remarks to the APWU convention this week, Senator Bernie Sanders said, "We cannot allow Donald Trump to privatize the Postal Service." The Vermont senator said that he would soon introduce legislation to block the White House effort. He told postal workers, "We will stand up, fight back, and defeat Trump's disastrous plan." The American people should not tolerate selling off a national treasure to corporate pirates who will cut postal service, raise prices, and destroy good-paying jobs, said APWU President Mark Diamonstein. Selling out the postal service threatens to stifle the growing e-commerce sector of the U.S. economy, Diamonstein added. It's easy to click on a website to make a purchase, but to deliver packages to every possible address in America, no matter how distant, Thousands of companies and tens of millions of consumers depend on the hard work of the women and men of the U.S. Postal Service. The APWU, along with other labor unions, environmental, religious, civil rights, and community organizations, participates in a grand alliance to save our public postal service. The alliance brings together more than 100 organizations advocating for expanded services and strengthening the USPS as a public institution and a communications hub for the 21st century.
That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Greg Swartz, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Well, they got women on TV, but
I still ain't satisfied.
'Cause co-optation's all I see, and
I still ain't satisfied.
They call me miss, they sell me blue jeans. Call it women's lip, they make it sound obscene. And I still ain't,
whoa, they lie.
I still ain't,
whoa, they lied,
and I still ain't.
Whoa, they lied,
and I still ain't satisfied. Well, they got women prison guards,
but I still ain't satisfied.
With so many still behind bars, and
I still ain't satisfied.
I don't plead guilt, I don't want no bum deal. I don't want crumbs, I want the whole meal. And I still ain't.
Whoa, they lied.
Whoa,
they lied.
I'm
gonna
cruise.
Whoa, they lied.
They lied, and I still ain't satisfied.
It started in 1920 with the passage of the 19th Amendment when women gained the right to vote. Here at KKFI, we're contributing to Women's Equality Week, 7 days to reflect on how women can improve places where there's still inequality.
Today, on this segment of the Heartland Labor Forum, we will discuss voter suppression of women. Voter suppression is a strategy to influence the outcome of any election by discouraging or preventing specific groups of people from voting. My name is Shaiklin Hampson. I will be your host for this segment of the Heartland Labor Forum. Trump stated that the voting system is rigged, and he got that right, though not in the way he thinks. And the consequences for women are serious. Every election, poor folks, transgender men and women, and communities of color across the genders have to jump through hurdles to access one of the basic American rights. Thanks to new voting rules that shorten polling hours, cut the number of polling places and districts, and change up the geographic voting lines and require IDs to vote. Our guest speaker today is Tony Van Pelt, president of NOW, National Organization of Women. Tony Van Pelt is a longtime feminist and humanist activist. Van Pelt oversees NOW's multi-issue agenda, which includes achieving constitutional equality for women, advancing reproductive rights and justice, and promoting racial justice. How are you today, Ms. Van Pelt?
I am very good, and thank you so much for having me on your show. And I am the president of the National Organization for Women.
Today I'll be asking you a series of questions. And my first question is, did women vote in the first years after suffrage, and what were some of the challenges?
Actually, from what I have read, in the 30s, that women felt like, oh, they had worked so hard for so long to attain the right to vote that they fragmented and started working on other issues. And in doing that, then they did not necessarily take advantage of their right to vote. And there was still that attitude of, this was a man's job. Right, it was a new right, and not all women embraced that right. So they did not vote in large numbers originally.
Do you still think that's true today, that women depend upon men to determine how they're going to vote at the polls?
I think that there is a segment of the population, in particular older white women, who do think that. And not just older white women, but I also think Latina women, women that come from these strong macho communities, do feel like that. I know when I knock on doors, I can sometimes be told by the women that answer the door that they just vote the way their husband tells them to vote.
Oh, wow.
But okay. I don't think that that's true in a majority of the cases, but I do think that it is true in a significant number of cases that could affect the outcome of an election.
Absolutely. What are the new voting laws that specifically impact women?
I'm from Florida, and one of the things that I can tell you is that with these voter identification laws, that they will significantly impact women and their right to vote. In Florida, to get a driver's license or a government-issued identification, they are making that more and more difficult, and in particular for women, because they're demanding that people show up and bring primary identification with them, and that includes an original or a certified birth certificate issued, you know, in the U.S. or the territories, and or they need a passport, and to get a passport, you need to go back to A, you need your birth certificate. They also are requiring, it's important to note that it's necessary for women that marriage certificates, court orders, divorce decrees, all of these things must be provided to tie the name of the woman on the primary identification, which is, you know, her birth name,
yes,
to the name that would be placed on their ID card or their driver's license card. And that's one of the requirements to get one of those identifications in the state of Florida, which can be very, very difficult for women.
Right. The challenges seem to be very strong for women who are over 70 years of age. When doing research for the show, I came across an article about a 93-year-old woman. Her name is Thelma Mitchell. She cleaned the Tennessee Capitol for 30 years. She never received a birth certificate because she was delivered by a midwife in Alabama in 1918, and there was no record of her birth. When she attempted to obtain a voter ID, she was turned away for lack of a birth certificate by a clerk who suggested that she could be an illegal immigrant. And there were multiple examples like that. Even a Texas judge, Sandra Watts, her driver's license was considered insufficient under the state's new voter ID laws because her license lists both her surname and her middle name. And the state voting rolls, you know, contained only her given middle name. As a judge, she was able to get resources, you know, in order to get to vote, but it's numerous situations like that.
Well, and not only that, but sometimes they charge for these things. And people who live in poverty have a very, very hard time, first of all, getting to the place that they have to go, to the driver's license office. Secondly, coming up with these documentations. Another thing in Florida is you have to have two proofs of residence from, like, residency from, like, the utility company, you know, the electricity company. Well, what if it's not in your name? In my household, those bills are not in my name. They're in my partner's name. So they have many, many barriers that they put up for women and people in poverty, we have to say that, and men also, to come up with these identifications. And there really is no rhyme or reason to why we would be insisting on this.
Mm-hmm.
Except to keep people from voting.
Looking at voter ID and gender, specifically people in the LGBTIA community, how does this apply to women, and what is its effect under the new voter ID laws?
Well, what's going to happen when you have to have this identification, if they refuse to, on proof of citizen, on proof of identification, they have your gender listed. So, you know, these folks are making that a primary issue to disempower people who are transitioning or who are transgendered. That's a big issue for them. Or if you're a lesbian couple and you're married, again, if you take another name, you have to go back to your original name. So it's just another way to disempower another group that folks that are in power these days don't want them to be able to vote. And, you know, if you can't vote, then you cannot elect the people that are going to stand for your particular rights. And for women, we're talking about reproductive justice. Reproductive rights is one of the big things for us. We won't have really great laws passed unless we can get people in office as far as family leave is concerned, or child care issues are concerned, or equal pay is concerned for women. These are huge issues, and we have to be able to vote to put the right people in office that will uphold our rights.
And this is Judy, and Shaiklin had an emergency phone call. Unfortunately, she's got family in the hospital. But let me ask you the next question. We're in Kansas City, Missouri, but we're right on the state line with Kansas, and our Secretary of State is Kris Kobach, who is was the head of the Trump Voter Commission that went defunct.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure you've heard of him. Anyway, I mean, we've heard lots of justifications from him about, you know, why we need these new voting laws. What do you think is the justification? Is there any justification that makes any sense at all?
No, I don't think there's any. They just want to keep people from the polls. You know, you can go back in history when we start talking about people of color. I mean, women of color, even though it's almost 100 years since the voting rights, since women got the right to vote, it's only 55 years since effectively black women were finally welcomed at the polls. And welcome is probably not the right word. Yeah. Because we had to pass in 1965 the Voting Rights Act. So that to protect minorities, so that they could actually physically vote at the polls.
Isn't it true also that, I'm just thinking about their motivation for doing this, and, you know, don't women tend to vote more Democrat than Republican?
Well, yes. I mean, if you read the party platforms, you can understand why that would be the case. Because Democrats tend to stand up for women's rights. They are pro-choice in their platform. They are for women's birth control. They are for women's right to self-autonomy. Or the Republicans are not. They want to continue to oppress women and keep them in a submissive role. They don't want to have women leadership.
Do you think that part of the motivation for voter suppression of women has to do with the fact that women aren't going to vote for those same people who are in office who are passing these laws?
Absolutely. There's no question of that. Absolutely no question of that. And let's just admit it. We're talking about the Republicans, the people who are in charge now, which, you know, takes us right into gerrymandering and how that disempowers people and their vote and to be able to vote for the person that they want to see holding that elective office.
Okay, I have a question. And this is going to sound a little weird to our listeners, but it is relevant. Does voter suppression endanger reproductive rights? And can you expound upon that as much as you want?
Well, yes, it does, of course, because when we put these people, these reactionaries and these oppressive people into office, they get very, very busy writing laws, passing laws that limit women's access and affordability to safe abortion. As we've seen with the Affordable Health Care Act, are dismantling that as fast as they can, which, of course, affects women and people in poverty at the most. They don't want women to have access to birth control. Why is this? Why are they so wrapped up in controlling women and women's health care and women's reproductive rights? I don't know, but it's very important for us. They also use these laws to disempower women in their careers and how much money that they can earn. And they use these laws. They use sexual assault and rape also as a part of that. I'm sorry to get off topic. I'm on my, you know.
Oh, continue on.
Yeah, I'm on my hobby horse. I mean, it's okay. Just so frightening what goes on, not just here in this country, but around the world. And it's the same thing. They pass, for the LGBTQIA plus community, they pass these laws that, like their bathroom laws, which is really none of their business. I mean, we all have bathrooms in our homes. Many of us have more than one bathroom, and we don't have gender-specific bathrooms, and it's fine.
I wanted to take a moment to let our listeners know that you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our guest today is Tony Van Pelt, the president of NOW, And also joining us in the studio today is the executive producer of our show, Judy Ansel.
And you are?
And I am Shaikalyn Hams, your host today. Okay, now, why, just tell us, be frank with us, why are there so many roadblocks to voting for women?
Well, I think that there are so many vote blocks because one-third of all women have citizenship documents that are do not identically match their current names, primarily because of name changes at marriage. So roughly 90% of women who are married adopt their husband's last name. And this is the same thing for the lesbian couples, where one of them adopts the last name of another, so that they lose their identity. And there's also adoption. When children are adopted, when they come from other countries, when they come from this country, when they their parents are divorced and their parents remarried and they're adopted, they lose their names. Women are being disenfranchised because men don't want them to have power. The other reason is that many women will vote for women who are running for office, and this is another reason why men don't want women to have the right to vote, or they try and block them from voting.
Well, that's quite interesting. So looking at the roadblocks to voting for women, do you think that the suppression of the women's votes in the next front is the next front in the war on women?
Oh, yes.
Or is it
Absolutely.
The primary front?
I'm sorry, what?
Or is it the primary front?
I think that it probably, yeah, I don't think that it's the next front. I think it's something that we've been dealing with for quite a while. And, you know, the one thing that we haven't touched on is that more and more women are being put in prison. And once they come out, they've lost their right to vote if they've had a felony charge. And more states are making it more difficult for people with felony charges to become able to vote again. And they put up a lot of blocks for that. This is another thing that's really huge in the state of Florida. You almost can never vote again if you continue to live in the state of Florida if you have a felony charge. And again, the reason for that is that the Republicans don't want to have these people be able to vote them out of office.
Tony, we're getting ready to wrap up, but I want to leave you with this, and then I'd like for you to give something to our listeners to take back with them. I have two questions. Is voter suppression of women on steroids in this upcoming election? Then also, is voter suppression a disenfranchisement to the most vulnerable members of our society?
Yes. Yes, of course, to both of those questions. And I do want to bring up to your listeners, though, that in 2020, it will be the 100th anniversary of a woman's right to vote, and it'll be the 55th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, which affects people of color and women of color especially. And this is a time for us, and 2020 is a presidential election, so this is the time to get the vote out. 2018 is right here. Our elections are coming up in November. Let's make sure that we can vote. Let's get out there and register other people to vote, and then let's make sure that we all get to the polls to vote so that we can stop this.
Absolutely. Judy, do you have any closing remarks?
Well, I just have another question for you, Tony Van Pelt. What is NOW doing specifically to try to fight the voter suppression of women? And what do you think people here, our listeners, should be doing in order to expand the right to vote for women?
Okay, here's what I think. First of all, what NOW is doing is NOW is all about the grassroots. So I'm at the National Action Center in Washington, D.C., and our mission is to help our grassroots locally in their hometowns, in their home states. So the first thing listeners can do is find out what are their laws in their state. They should become educated, and then they can work with their local officials, with those that are willing to affect those laws, to change those laws, to lobby for more liberal laws, and to help in any way they can. I know in my hometown, my grassroots chapter in St. Petersburg, Florida, works with to enfranchise felons. We work with people that are coming out of prison to try and help them get their right to vote. So I think that those are the most important things that people can do. They can become educated, they can see what needs to be done in their state, and then they can work for those rights for themselves and for others.
Thank you very much, Tony Van Pelt. Listeners, you've been listening to Tony Van Pelt, the national president of NOW, and also joining us today in the studio is Judy Ansel.
And you are?
And I am Shaikalyn Hams, your host today.
We ought to turn that into an act.
Okay.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you so much for thinking of me. I appreciate it.
We're doing this interview in conjunction with Women's Equality Week,
yes,
which is going on all week this week with many events in Kansas City. So thanks for being part of it, Tony.
My pleasure.
KKFI is the Kansas City area's independent, non-commercial community radio station. We seek to stimulate, educate, and entertain our audience to reflect the diversity of the local and world community, and to provide a channel for individuals and groups, issues and music that have been overlooked, suppressed, or underrepresented by other media. Interested in volunteering? Contact 816-994-7864 or go online at kkfi.org and click the volunteer tab. Thank you for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
While we're trying to get our next guest on the air, I'm going to do the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. This is Judy Ansel. So this is Women's Equality Week, as you heard from our last segment with our interview with Tony Van Pelt. And there are several more events going on. You can find out what they are if you go to the Women's Equality Week Facebook page. But also Saturday, they're going to be showing a movie called Anne Braden, Southern Patriot, The Extraordinary Life and Legacy of American Civil Rights Leader. It's Saturday at noon at the Tivoli Theater. And Unite for Justice KC, Stop Kavanaugh, Sunday, August 26th, 1 o'clock p.m., this is at 4141 Pennsylvania Avenue. This is hosted by Veterans for Peace, Our Revolution KC, Individual KC Sierra Club,
350KC and NARAL Pro-Choice Missouri. Empower Missouri First Friday Forum. Stand with the Immigrants, Friday, September 7th, 11:30 a.m., KCMO Central Library, 14 West 10th Street. Bring a sack lunch. Celebrate Labor Day again with a reading by professional union actors. The week after Labor Day, they're reading Studs Terkel's Working. That's Monday, September 10th at 6:30 p.m. at the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch. This is sponsored by EARTH, Equity Actors Readers Theater. And you can find our whole calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. And now I'm turning it over to Hester.
Well, welcome. Welcome. I understand that you've had a busy day traveling.
Yeah, I have had a very busy day traveling. I've been in Cooperstown, New York, and now I'm in the city of Chicago.
Oh, that's wonderful. We were concerned talking about the time you fly around in Chicago before you can land. Well, you were part of the organization Our Revolution, and I see we have one here in Kansas City. I just wondered, so what is it you're doing right now?
So I'm a senior advisor to Bernie Sanders' political campaign.
Okay. I was so relieved that when the election was over that he just didn't hang up his hat. It was like he just kept on going.
I've been with him for some 30 years, so that's the way he is. He is constantly working to advance the progressive agenda. That's been his life's work, and he has more energy and vigor than most people I know, including me. And he just keeps going. So he's really a phenomenal human being.
Well, that just showed that he wasn't giving up. This was not just about a specific event, but it was for his life.
No, that's right. It's about building a movement that can take power for working class people in this country.
I'm a retired member of CWA, and I have to say that having been involved with legislative things for a long time, was quite taken aback when our higher people signed up with him before we ever had a primary, and that there's never been a time when we ever did that.
Oh, is that right?
Labor doesn't do that. They usually let the primaries take care of it and then invest their money and their time in the ones that survive. But that was not the case this time.
CWA and all the folks, CWA folks around the country were just tremendous in the last campaign. It was really, along with folks in some of the other unions as well, the postal workers, the nurses, certainly the transit workers. We had locals all around the country who were also, incredibly active. So it was very gratifying to see the kind of grassroots labor support coming out for Bernie.
And I believe it's still there. What is the plan now? I have a friend, and he's retired labor, and he has been talking about a revolution for the last 15, 20 years. And it looked like it was finally starting to happen. Some things that weren't.
It's happening. It's not starting to happen. It's happening all over the country. People are winning offices. The mainstream media doesn't really pick it up. What's going on at the grassroots? They didn't in 2016, and they're still not picking it up. But all across the country, people are running for office for the first time. People are actually winning up and down the ballot. So it's really an exciting time to be involved in progressive politics in America. There's really a grassroots upsurge in support and interest, and it's making a big difference. And look, it's making a difference not only in electing people, but the Democratic Party itself is moving substantially in a more progressive direction. The platform that was passed in 2016, the most progressive in the history of the party, basically. And so there's been a tremendous amount of movement. I saw a statistic that half of the candidates running for Congress who raised $1,000 or more in Democratic primaries of Medicare for All in their literature. Well, that 4 years ago, that would have been unheard of. So just a tremendous amount of energy and excitement, and it really is moving in a much more progressive and humane direction.
Well, the revolution is for all, is the betterment of all, I believe. And do you see any change within the Republican Party as far as the way they're going?
Well, the Republican Party has been hijacked by Trump. It is the party of Trump. Who essentially is governing in a sort of strongman model. moving, trying to move the country in a more authoritarian direction with less equality and less equity. And the, you know, the Republican Party has largely followed him along that path. And, you know, the Republican tax bill that was passed was a big payoff to the rich donors who supported him and who have supported the party for the for years. And so they got what they wanted, which was, you know, huge tax breaks for them and their corporations. So, you know, the Republican Party is completely out of touch with the needs of the American people and, in fact, is moving us in exactly the wrong direction. You know, the liberal democracies of Western Europe had to confront this in the early 20th century, and now we're dealing with it here in our own country. And so we all have to be vigilant and stay active in politics to make, you know, make sure our country does not go over a tipping point in terms of its rightward movement under people like Trump.
One of the things that was so impressive and just surprising was the campaign included so many young people, minority people who normally were not engaged. How was that? How did that all happen?
Well, look, you know, people responded to Bernie's message. And, you know, despite what you read in the media, the truth of the matter is that Bernie won millennials of all races. And, you know, and when they polled millennials after the election season was over and said, why did you support him? And they said, because he was the candidate who, you know, best understood the problems that, you know, I as an individual person are facing. And so, you know, there's a tremendous, you know, young people, you know, rallied strongly to Bernie. They still are rallying to him because they understand that, you know, just because things are a certain way doesn't mean that's the way they have to be. And that all of these things are intentional, and we just have to be intentional in a progressive way, and we can bring change to this country. So, you know, young people were, you know, the early part of our base, and it broadened over time. But again, it was across all races, and was really, you know, it was incredible to be at those rallies with 30,000 people, you know, really sort of bringing the house down. So.
Well, I have two millennials.
That was a very exciting part of the campaign.
I have two millennials that I count in my family, and they were solid Bernie, and they had to win me over because, as an older woman, I was leaning toward Hillary because I knew her so well. She's, you know, we thought we did, but and when my local, when my union said this is who we support, of course that's the direction you go in. But they were so passionate, just so passionate, and I was so sorry that it worked out like that.
It, you know, as we went state to state in the process, what was interesting is we would come into a state and, you know, he would have overwhelming support among young people. And then, you know, as he campaigned in the state, that would, it would sort of invariably move up the age band. You know, then it would move into the 30-somethings and the 40-somethings and the 50-somethings. And that's, you know, that's how we put together the coalition we needed in each state to win. But it really started with the young people. And as I said, they are really leaders for change in this country now. You know, young people are getting elected. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being one of them, but there are others as well. And you know, what's wonderful about that is, of course, every election there's even more new young people who weren't eligible to vote in the last election and now can vote in this election. And you know, over time, the country will become more and more progressive.
Absolutely, it's the direction is has the. Movement has already started. What do you think about is Andrea Ocasio-Cortez, her different approach with the higher education? She is not so much college. She's more for vocational education.
Well, I people need to be have the skills that they need to be successful in the economy. And for some people, that will be a four-year college degree. For some people, it might be a two-year college degree. Some people will be you know, more than 4 years if you go to medical school or get advanced education. But there also is a tremendous need in this country for vocational education, and that has to be available to people as well as the more traditional college education. So it is very important that we deal with education, you know, beyond high school in every area so that, you know, people have the skills that they need to create income for their family in an increasingly competitive global economy. So I think you would find Bernie is as well a big fan of vocational education. But, you know, we need to make sure that higher education of all kinds is available to everybody, regardless of, you know, what zip code they grew up in or how much money their family has. You know, the amount of debt that people are being saddled with, you know, coming out of school is incredible. And, you know, it really is a drag on our economy, and other advanced democracies don't do it this way. You know, college is largely free or totally free. And the truth is, in this country, people forget that college used to be largely free in the United States of America. So we've got to, in that sense, we've got to get back to our roots in terms of higher education and make sure that it is open to everybody based on merit.
That's true. Higher education has become a business. And we have had stories where they were, how much the presidents would make of those universities. And you're looking at $15, $20 million. How many kids' tuition does that mean? I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, and you know, there's this competition going on among institutions of higher learning in terms of investments in brick and mortar. And that's very expensive as well. And, you know, many schools that don't have large endowments, that is also being paid for out of tuition dollars. So that's something we need to take a look at as well, this sort of a competition for facilities, which is really pushing the costs up at a lot of schools.
What was it that you handled in the campaign that made you the most proud, that you thought was successful and it really brought you happiness?
Well, I don't know about happiness, because it was obviously a tremendously intense experience. And, you know, there were sometimes weeks I look back and the whole, you know, past few weeks had been just a blur. And it was difficult to sort of figure out what went on in one day versus another. But I do think what was really incredible about the campaign, you know, you talked about young people. You know, one of the things that we did in Iowa was we really made an effort to reach out to high school seniors, because in Iowa and in a lot of places, people who are 17 who are going to be 18 by the general election are able to participate in the primary or caucus. That's not true everywhere, but in many places it is. And we really made an effort to reach out to the sort of next generation of voters. So it wasn't just people who were 18 or over, but we really tried to reach out to the next generation of young voters. And we got an incredible response, because, you know, young people in general, and certainly high school seniors, even when they're eligible to vote in a primary caucus, are largely ignored by traditional candidates who view them as too, quote unquote, unreliable in terms of their voting patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, we really made an effort to reach out to folks, and we really brought them out. And, you know, voting is something that, you know, the studies have shown, if you start early and vote frequently, that it's a pattern that continues throughout your life. And, you know, really have a problem in this country with low voter turnout in general, and particularly among younger people. And I was proud to be part of an effort that really wanted to reach out to people and get them to participate in the political process.
And it was successful. I'm so sorry that we were not able to catch up with you sooner than we did. I'd like to spend some more time with you. But as we wrap up, can you tell us what you would like us to do? Is Bernie, he was here a couple of months ago, is he going to be back?
Oh, I'm sure he will be back. He is crisscrossing the country, trying to elect progressive Democrats up and down the ballot. He was just down in Florida, in fact, campaigning for Andrew Gillum, who is running for governor of Florida, mm-hmm. and is in a hard-fought primary, and as well as endorsing some the down-ballot folks in Florida as well. So he is all over the country and will continue to be through the midterms.
Okay.
Because we have got to elect a Democratic Congress to put the brakes on this outrageous Trump administration.
Thank you. Well, we'll encourage our people to go to Our Revolution, find our local office here. And if you are ever in Kansas City, please give Judy Ansel a call, and we'll meet up with you and have a wonderful discussion.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Jeffrey Weaver, for being with us this evening. Hi, this is Judy Ansel, and it's time for Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you. Welcome to the show. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, so you want to talk about Mr. Kavanaugh, the judge, or the judge nominee for the Supreme Court. He doesn't have a very good track record with labor, does he?
His track record with labor is, in so many words, terrible, which is why the AFL-CIO decided to oppose him, along with many other groups. Just to give you the worst example, a trained killer whale in Florida killed its trainer, and OSHA fined SeaWorld in Florida for basically not protecting the trainer. Turned out this was the fourth trainer the killer whale had killed, and Kavanaugh dissented.
A serial killer whale.
Yeah.
And he dissented?
He sided with the killer whale. He said you can't protect everybody against everything, and this is not what the Occupational Safety and Health Act envisioned when it was passed in 1970. And then he said, what's next? Football tackling? So just as one,
wow.
That was
well,
his example.
You know, I just found a case that he dissented on. It was the agriprocessors case, which was about that meatpacking plant in Iowa that had that horrific immigration raid under the Bush administration. And the workers later on were trying to organize, and there was an NLRB decision because a number of them were undocumented. And all of the court he was on decided that the workers had status as workers and they therefore had rights, labor rights to organize. And Kavanaugh dissented despite multiple Supreme Court decisions and said that because they were undocumented, they did not have any labor rights. That's a horrific decision.
Yes, and that's been part of his pattern. Another part of it was during the Bush administration, this is George W., tried to basically abolish merit pay in the Defense Department for their civilian workers. The government worker unions took the Bush administration to court. Basically, everything would be up to the boss. The boss could hire and fire and demote you and cut your pay, and you would have very little appeal rights or anything else. The courts tossed the Defense Department's attempt to let the bosses have total control. Kavanaugh dissented again. So
that's
basically where he is, and that's why workers were out in the streets this past Wednesday in a demonstration organized by the Coalition for Labor Union Women, and why they're going to be out in the streets this coming Sunday.
Right.
And the city and everywhere else.
Yeah, I just announced that here in Kansas City at 1 p.m. on Sunday, there's going to be a demonstration against Kavanaugh at 4141 Pennsylvania, hosted by none other than Veterans for Peace and Our Revolution. We just had somebody from Our Revolution on the show. So they're pretty active.
Right.
And Indivisible and several other organizations. So
what
are the chances, do you think, that they'll actually be able to hold up this nomination?
The chances are up in the air. There are four Democratic senators who are under a lot of pressure to vote for Kavanaugh because they're running for re-election in states that Trump carried handily. One of them is Claire McCaskill.
Right.
Right.
She met with him this week.
Republican senators who are under pressure to vote against Kavanaugh because these two Republicans, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine, have said they are pro-choice. They want to make sure that he's pro-choice as well.
That means
if you know anybody in Alaska and Maine, get on the phone and have them call their senators to make sure that to make sure that they vote the correct way, because Kavanaugh's position on reproductive choice is as bad as his position on labor, from what we can tell.
Well, and now his position on presidential pardons and the rights of the president may be the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. This week's happenings with Trump's lawyer pleading guilty, and because I think a number of people might feel a little squeamish about putting somebody on the court who thinks the president can get away with anything.
Yes, yes, and that was Kavanaugh's position in a speech, not in court, but in a speech at Notre Dame University about 6 years ago. So, and that but it was also his position. Let's not forget, before he was an appellate court judge, he was a politician in the Bush White House. He was part of that mob of lawyers that invaded Florida on behalf of the Bush campaign to skew the count there. So, in other words, he was a GOP
so
he's operative.
He's also really partisan then, too, it appears.
Yes.
Interesting pick. Well, we're going to leave it at that. Mark, I hope you enjoy whatever demonstration you go to this weekend, and we will enjoy ours.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks, Mark Grunberg. This has been Washington Window on Workers. We'll talk to you next month. Okay, so that's it for the show. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're going to be talking about another cheery subject, the attack on public employee unions and how they are resisting. And I hope we have some good stories about that. Thanks to tonight's engineers. That's it. Good night. Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The comments.